The following podcast is banned in the state of Florida for talking about a dangerous leftist book, the Bible. Like the Bible, this podcast contains frank discussions on sensitive topics, including sex, violence, and cursing. Please proceed with caution. But God can also turn the desert into watery pools, thirsty ground into watery springs, where God settles the hungry. They even build a city and live there. They plant fields and vineyards and obtain a fruitful harvest. God blesses them, and they become many. This is the word in black and red.
And welcome to the Word in Black and Red, where we read the Bible from a leftist and liberationist perspective to elucidate the way people of faith and their comrades can understand the Bible as a source of healing, love, and liberation for all people. I am your host, Michael Belong, the wise old Lama MB, joined today once again by the wonderful Josiah, Pastor Don, and Elle. And if you couldn't tell already, it's just always wonderful to have these particular folks. We're already in line for an excellent, excellent podcast. So as always, you can join Josiah at Church of Christ the Anarchist on Instagram, or your favorite podcast player at Pulp, P-U-L-P, exclamation point. And Pastor Don, you can find at Unfinished Communities. And Elle, you can find on the new and upcoming show we're hoping to launch soon. Is it Sinners and Saints or Saints and Sinners?
Saints and Sinners.
All right, on the new show, Saints and Sinners, which I am very excited to hear all about the life and passion of Dorothy Day. And I'm supposedly working on an episode about Billy Graham, but I cannot bring myself to read anything else about that terrible bastard. So anyway, so you won't have to, because someone else will have read it and digested it for you, and you can just get the most horrible bits in one convenient package that is definitely not stolen from behind the bastards in any way legally. And so we'll go ahead and jump right on in to Genesis 42. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why are you staring blankly at each other? I've just heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so we can survive and not starve to death." So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. However, Jacob didn't send Joseph's brother Benjamin along with his brothers, because he thought something bad might happen to him. Israel's sons came to buy grain with others who also came, since the famine had spread to the land of Canaan. As for Joseph, he was the land's governor, and he was the one selling grain to all the land's people. When Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him, their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he acted like he didn't know them. He spoke with them with a harsh tone and said, "Where have you come from?" And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Joseph recognized his brothers, but they didn't recognize him. Joseph remembered the dreams he had dreamed about them, and he said to them, "You are spies. You've come to look for the country's weaknesses." They said to him, "No, master. Your servants have just come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants aren't spies." He said to them, "No, you've come to look for the country's weaknesses." They said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, but one is gone." Joseph said to them, "It's just as I have said to you. You are spies, but here is how to prove yourselves. As Pharaoh lives, you won't leave here until your youngest brother arrives. Send one of you to get your brother, but the rest of you will stay in prison. We will find out if your words are true. If not, as Pharaoh lives, you are certainly spies." He then put them all in prison for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I am a God-fearing man. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay in prison and the rest of you go. Take grain back to those in your households who are hungry. But bring your youngest brother back to me so that your words will prove true and you won't die." So they prepared to do this. The brothers said to each other, "We are clearly guilty for what we did to our brother when we saw his life in danger and when he begged us for mercy, but we didn't listen. That's why we're in this danger now." Reuben responded to them, "Didn't I tell you? Don't do anything wrong to the boy." But you wouldn't listen. So now this is payback for his death. They didn't know that Joseph was listening to them because they were using an interpreter. He stepped away from them and wept. When he returned, he spoke with them again. Then he took Simeon from them and tied him up in front of them. Then Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put back each man's silver into his own sack, and to give them provisions for their trip. And it was done. They loaded their grain onto their donkeys, and they set out. When they stopped to spend the night, one of them opened his sack to feed his donkey, and he saw his silver at the top of his sack. He said to his brothers, "My silver's been returned. It's right here in my sack." Their hearts stopped. Terrified, they said to each other, "What has God done to us?" When they got back to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they described to him everything that had happened to them. "The man, the country's governor, spoke to us with a harsh tone and accused us of being spies in the country. We told him, 'We're honest men, not spies. We are 12 brothers, all our father's sons. One of us is gone, but the youngest is right now with our father in the land of Canaan.' The man, the country's governor, told us, 'This is how I will know you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me. Take grain for those in your households who are hungry, and go. But bring back your youngest brother to me. Then I will know that you are not spies, but honest men. I will give your brother back to you, and you may travel throughout the country.' When they opened their sacks, each man found a pouch of his silver in his sack. When they and their father saw their pouches of silver, they were afraid. Their father Jacob said to them, 'You've taken my children from me. Joseph's gone, Simeon's gone, and you are taking Benjamin. All this can't really be happening to me.' Reuben said to his father, 'You may put both of my sons to death if I don't bring him back to you. Make him my responsibility, and I will make sure he returns to you.' But Jacob said to him, 'My son won't go down with you because his brother's dead and he's been left all alone. If anything were to happen to him on the trip you are taking, you would send me, old as I am, to my grave in grief.'" This passage comes in the middle of two passages, right? Where we see, on the one hand, Joseph began to take power in the region, right? Joseph interprets the dream. Joseph gets the dream. He comes to power. He begins taking power. He begins taking power away from the native villages of Egypt and consolidating it in the city and consolidating it under Pharaoh. And then we see here in this story, it affects even his family off all the way in Canaan. And this happens in the middle. And if you, dear listener, do not know the end of the Joseph story, I'm not going to spoil it for you. You have to listen to the podcast, or you could just read the Bible yourself. I'm not going to gatekeep that from you. This story will go on to be very dramatic as it continues on for a little ways. But here in this story, we really see a bunch of things that were brought up earlier in the text coming back into play here. But first, I want to highlight the fact that this episode is called Joseph the Cop and point out that the way that power is really being used here.
The first point I want to say is, on opening, before we dig into all the rest of about Joseph being a cop and whatnot, my reaction when I read this, and it was the same reaction I did when our pod covered this, is very simply, fuck you, Reuben, you're not helping. Like, I mean, there is a profound stupidity present in Reuben here, which even, you know, hear me being on brand again, there's Robert Alter, even calls out here as saying, like, what the hell, dude? Like, he's mourning the potential loss of a son. And you're like, hey, if it makes you feel any better, you can kill a couple of your grandkids, too. Like, what the hell, man? Alter even goes so far as to explain that this is not the only moment in the story where we sense that Reuben's claim to preeminence among the brothers as firstborn is dubious, and he will be displaced by Judah, the fourthborn. Like, yeah, he's an idiot. Also, as the dedicated, shall we say, ordained Protestant minister slash dick joke enthusiast on the podcast, my other point is this. Fuck the police. Seriously. Fuck them.
Reuben's still trying to make up from raping his stepmom-ish. And, you know, this line of logic just continues on to, well, maybe I can make up for it by murdering your grandkids, pops. Reuben's not going to do anything good in this life.
This sounds to me like a guy who was just looking for an excuse.
Yeah, I hate my kids too. Yeah.
I mean, and like, it has to have happened between these two scenarios, right? Like Reuben sleeping with his stepmom has to happen between Joseph being sold into slavery and this part of the story, right? Like, I mean, this is, again, one of those situations where it's like, because the book of Genesis in particular is several different traditions being formed into one, like, there's competing stories here. And so in Genesis 35, where there is just this throwaway line about Reuben sleeping with his stepmom, or, you know, Yeah, sister mom. With Reuben sleeping with his dad's spouse, right, is that it's not entirely clear if that's even in the same tradition as the rest of the Joseph story, right? Is that something that's still at play here? I think it's more interesting to read the Joseph story as Reuben continuously trying to make up for that. But because it doesn't happen chronologically in a very clear way, you know, we're not sure if Benjamin is born before Isaac dies, right? And so it lists here that Jacob had these 12 sons. It's not entirely clear to me whether or not that is something that happens before Isaac dies. Now, I think it probably makes sense that Reuben has to have done this before Isaac dies, because then Reuben could possibly be the father of one of his brothers, and that would be fucked up chronologically.
Well, I'm not going to fix this per se, because, yeah, it's fucked up and unclear. But the discussion about like lineage and relationship here does bring into mind another interesting point here that we don't talk about very much, which is the fact of the relationship between Joseph and Benjamin. Now, I don't know about you all, but this was always talked about in Sunday school, like, well, Benjamin was the youngest, so his father loved him the most. And yeah, there may be a piece of that, but also maybe not, because what Alter points out here is a very different structure to the relationship, which is the fact that Benjamin here is Joseph's brother, not half-brother. He's the only other son of Rachel. And that is something that is very rarely commented on when this passage is discussed. Is we can talk about Reuben's fuck-ups until we're blue in the face, or like focusing on this is something that, like, honestly, we don't do very much and puts a whole new spin on the dynamic. And when we look at how, say, Joseph specifically highlighted the left-behind youngest son who he knew to be Benjamin as the one that he wanted as a ransom, there's a whole level to that family dynamic taking shape there that we never, ever comment on. That could have a lot to do with maybe Joseph thinking to save his full brother from a potentially abusive situation. There's so many other dynamics here that are at play beyond Reuben the fuck up, Jacob the who knows what the hell this guy's into this time, all the brothers being insane in their own different ways. Like, there's so many interconnected family dynamics here. And this thread of the interplay between Joseph and Benjamin forms almost an unseen backbone to the entire story that really informs somewhat. And I say somewhat because I remind what Micah said earlier about Joseph being a cop. It may inform it somewhat, but doesn't necessarily justify it. But it does inform the behaviors at play here on Joseph's side and somewhat on Jacob's side as well, I think.
Well, I think part of the reason we never hear about, you know, Benjamin being Joseph's brother as opposed to half-brother is because, I don't know, this is just my speculation, but if you start talking about, you know, brothers and half-brothers in Sunday school, then all these biblical heroes and Bibles and folks in Bible stories don't have this perfect nuclear family. And we don't want kids hearing about that.
It's
just, I don't know, it's this weird, icky fascist vibes. But also, there's three times that Joseph cries or weeps. The first, when he meets his brothers, and he's overcome and he goes and cries in his room. And then the second, when he first lays eyes on Benjamin. And the third, when he makes himself known to his brothers. So yeah, it adds so much more to the story. And also, I don't know about you, and I don't remember if it was even stated explicitly, but there's this parallel of Joseph being the one that Jacob was protective over when he got his robe. And then, and this time around, Benjamin, similarly, same mother, also one of the younger ones, is the one that Jacob is protective over again. So there's this parallel between Joseph and Benjamin there as well.
And what does that say about Jacob's relationship with Rachel? Like, that's the shadow over the whole thing, is that Jacob's favoritism, like, we were always, I grew up in a conservative Sunday school, so I'm familiar with that, not vaguely, but very much so fascist architecture by which the story is expressed. But like, that's the shadow lying over the whole thing. The favoritism isn't, oh, he was the youngest or he was just the favorite. Like, there is a whole element to the harem-esque relationship dynamics of the time where the real favorite in this story wasn't Joseph or Benjamin, it was Rachel. Like, she was the favorite. And the treatment of Joseph and Benjamin and all the other brothers is an extension of that favoritism and not of anything else. But we can't ever talk about that, because then we have to talk about people having multiple wives. And then, oh my God, who would ever vote for Trump?
What's kind of funny is this favoritism of Rachel is like, it absolutely mirrors in Sister Wives, the TLC TV show, Cody Brown's favoritism of Robin. Because, like, now that's, like, completely destroyed his relationship with his other kids. Mm. And he won't hear of the favoritism that he has of Robin. Like, any critique of that is, like, no, you are going against the patriarchy. And he says that, like, it's really funny.
I think another dynamic that is worth elucidating here in this passage is that Benjamin had to be a kid when Joseph was taken, right? We know that Benjamin is the youngest. He's younger than Joseph. I sat and watched somebody trying to figure out all the math to figure out exactly how old Benjamin was. And it's not clear to me that the math was good by any means. But, you know, Benjamin was probably around 10. And being about 10, like, and then suddenly this person who is your full sibling, right, the person that you're presumably the closest with in the world, is suddenly gone, and then you don't see him again for a long time, right? And I love, Josiah, that you brought up the times that Joseph weeps in this story, the three times that he weeps, and one of them being specifically about his brother Benjamin, that the person he was closest to in this dysfunctional family, right, to be very clear, person he was closest to, his youngest brother, who he has not seen since he was probably 10 years old, and now he sees him as a man, how many emotions can be going through his head, right? That he's going through this, I've missed the last 20 years of my brother's life, I've not been a part of his life, but he's alive and he's doing well and all of these other things, and my brothers haven't tried to kill him too, just like they tried to kill me, right? All of those things going on here.
There's a level of tragedy to that as well, because notwithstanding the sheer stupidity involved in attempting to do biblical math, you should never do that, never, ever, ever. Yeah. That way creationism lies. But the presumption here then of Benjamin as the youngest child is that Benjamin was probably toddler, if not infant, at the time that Joseph was, shall we say, given unto the pit. And in that scenario, Joseph probably didn't have a relationship with Benjamin. So to a certain degree, like, the relationship that he has with Benjamin is based largely on lineage and possibly might even be entirely in Joseph's head. And there is a certain degree of tragedy to that. Like, his fixation on Benjamin could be an existing relationship, because, again, the math is fucking weird. Like, there's no way that we can know for sure. But if we take it as read that Benjamin was really quite young, then what we have here is Joseph fixating on a relationship born not out of interpersonal interaction, but as an expression of his own trauma, almost like an early version of modern parasocial relationships.
Joseph's relationship or mental relationship with, you know, like, knowing kind of the logical thing to assume that with Joseph gone, Benjamin does become his father's favorite, coming from his favorite wife, and would become all that much more possessive of them that way. He knows that Benjamin being ransomed would be that much more like kind of a father brothers, which is what all that silver in the sack was about.
Well, and the silver in the sack is like very directly a, this is what you sold me for, take it back.
But that's also like, I know this episode's titled Joseph the Cop. I don't think Joseph's proximity to power is at the cop level at all in this passage. It is more so like he's got the power of like being on top. He may not be Pharaoh, but he's like right under him. He's not just protecting the state or property, which is the function of cops. He's doing that much more, like wielding it for personal vendettas than. Mm-hmm. Like, cops can do a lot with their personal vendettas, but, like, in a time of a famine, like, having control of the food, like, that's much higher than cop shit.
Yeah, Joseph's power is way higher than that of a cop, but in function, the way that that power goes to his head and immediately tends towards violent abuse of people who've pissed him off is very cop-like.
He's absolute middle management material in terms of, like, toxic workplace. Like, this man was made for it. I mean, he went to prison and then bootlicked his way into being in charge of the other prisoners. Like, this is middle management right here.
You don't see it, but the Egyptian Empire runs on TPS reports. But the other side of this, too, is that God, this is one of the really tough parts at play, is that we have this biblical insight into the fact that Joseph, well, at a level higher than a cop, is acting out of that same kind of middle management abusive functionality that powers pretty much all of American policing at this point. And we have that cruelty at play, and we have that. But we also see, we get a peek behind the scene to something that we don't always get to see with American police. And, oh my God, this is going to sound like I'm actually supporting the police, but it needs to be said. Like, we can see Joseph's motivations. And so we know as the reader, and this makes it easier, as we do in conservative Sunday schools, as I well know, it makes it easier to dismiss Joseph's motivations as righteous because we know why he's doing it. And when we apply this same mentality to our modern environment, that's why we wind up with a lot of people who are, you know, sporting that thin blue line American flag and going to church, is because they know these people, they see the motivations that lead them to that point, and they think that it dismisses them. And the overall arc of the biblical narrative here is that it fucking doesn't. Like, Joseph's behavior towards his brothers is still sinful and evil, whether or not he has good reason for it. He's taking vengeance on his brothers. He's being cruel. He's being unkind. This interplay between motivations as justification is at the heart of really the American argument over policing. Is we don't have one side that thinks that all cops are evil horned monsters that are literal devils and demons, and on the other side thinks that they're angels. We have one side that sees their background and rationale and reasoning is a justification for evil, and another side that says there is no justification for evil. And I'll be like, again, as the ordained pastor slash dick joke enthusiast of record here, I'm going to go on record and say that from a Christian perspective, and this is directed at any police officer or who happens to be actually listening to this podcast, there isn't a justification. Like, to be intentionally participant in a system that is cruel by design, that is imperialistic by design, and that is violent by design, is a sinful act in and of itself. You can find another job. Like, if you need help, reach out to any one of us. I'm sure we'll be happy to help. But that being said, that doesn't mean that we don't see the justification. We don't not understand the reasoning. It's just not enough.
I would argue that motivations be damned. Motivations are just a red herring in what everyone knows, but no one on the conservative side, at least, will admit, which is that cops protect white supremacy, which conservatives benefit from. So nobody's going to say that, but you support the cops because they support your interests, which is your place in the society, whether or not you economic, whether or not you are lower class, struggling just to pay rent, or quote unquote middle class that isn't worried about retirement. Like, you still benefit from it, and so you're going to support it and make up whatever motivation fits your worldview.
And that's just proven so quickly by the fact that, like, as soon as the cops are defending a drag show, that conservatives will go and spit in their faces and threaten to shoot them. And, you know, suddenly they're ACAB when the cops are, you know, against their wishes, defending something that doesn't align with conservative cultural values.
And I'll bring it back again to the point interpersonally of recognizing the police officer in the mix of all of this, which, again, God, it sounds like I'm supporting the cops. I'm not. I'm really not. But I do want to bring it back to that point. An interaction I had with, I got three kids. My middle son and my eldest daughter had a fight fairly recently. They do on the order of once every 15 minutes anyway. So what the fuck, doesn't matter which one I'm talking about. They happen all the time. And my son had gone into my daughter's room to get something that he was never supposed to go in there in the first place. And he found that my daughter had taken something of mine that she wasn't supposed to have and had hid it under her bed. But he comes out, and he comes out to rat on her, and she catches him coming out of her room, and she basically decks him clear into next week. And so I sit down with the two of them and I have to explain, look, yes, he invaded your privacy. Yes, he wasn't supposed to be in there, but you also did a wrong thing. None of that matters because you punched him in the face. And the minute you did that, you became the bad guy. The rest of it became wildly irrelevant. Once you cross that line into violence and cruelty, there is no... Violence is not a proportional response to anything from a Christian perspective. And in a society, it's never helpful. Once you became complicit in using violence to enforce your opinion of what is right and wrong, the rationale behind it became irrelevant. Now, that doesn't mean I don't understand why you did it. And you're still my daughter, and I love you, just as I love all of the people who are complicit in evil things as people. But how much I love you and the relationship that we have does not have a bearing on the fact that you crossed the fucking line and are doing an evil thing, and you will be held accountable for that. And that the same logic, I truly feel, applies to police and really anyone who has made it their business to participate in the machinations of applying violence as a means of social control. There's no way to do that righteously. And by connecting yourself to that and trying to convince yourself that it's a righteous act, your justifications for it become irrelevant. Like, you're still doing the wrong thing.
And that is something that we need to directly apply to the situation going on in Israel-Palestine, right? That
yep.
It doesn't matter. Even if Israel was perfectly justified in responding to the attack by Hamas, and even if you ignore the 75 years of occupation, even if you ignore all the horrors that the Palestinians have faced, even if you ignore the ongoing genocide that have happened to the Palestinians for the past 75 years, even if you ignore all of that, if Israel was purely righteous in everything they did until right now when they started bombing people, killing 9,000 children, bombing 20,000 more people, which by the time that this comes out will almost certainly have doubled, destroyed every hospital in town, left 500,000 people on the edge of starvation, 1.9 million people without homes, there is no way to justify that. That is Nazi shit. That is a genocide. There is no justification for the horror that you are enacting on your fellow human being. And we can say, we can criticize Israel while we say that and say, no, we are not being anti-Semitic, because the most anti-Semitic thing you could do is wish that another people group committed a Holocaust. The worst thing you could say about another people group is that they have genocided another people. And to say that Israel represents the Jewish people is to be the most anti-Semitic thing that you could possibly do. The most anti-Semitic thing that you could possibly say is that Israel represents all Jewish people as they are murdering their fellow human being. I am anti-rich because the category of rich dehumanizes the human beings that are rich. I am anti-cop because the category of cop dehumanizes the individual humans who are police officers. I am anti-Israel because the category of Israeli government dehumanizes the people who exist within that Israeli government. I am pro the people who are rich, and I say, I am so pro the people who are rich, you should not be rich anymore. I am so pro the people who are cops, I'm saying you shouldn't be a cop anymore. I am so pro the Jewish people that I'm saying we should not be supporting any government that uses your name and the suffering that you have experienced to enact that suffering on other human beings.
I like that we brought the IDF in here. Have you guys seen...
Said no one ever.
you guys see all the thirst traps that IDF soldiers were posting? I think it was a month ago is when it started. Like... It was all this like,
ah, for years. When
you're criticizing Israel, you're criticizing this. And there was this pouty face. And it's the same response that when people say, complain about all cops are bastards. Well, no, some of them are very nice people, but I don't give a shit. It's not about whether or not they're a nice person. It's about the role that they perform. Like, I have a friend, she hates Christian Bale. She doesn't actually hate the dude. She hates the roles he performs. Same thing. Not the same thing, because Christian Bale doesn't shoot people for no reason in his personal life. But that is true. He is very protective over his personal life. And now that you say that, I kind of think I know why. But they're a bastard because of the role that they perform. They're not a bastard, you know, when they go home. You know, at least 60% of them aren't. They're not a bastard when they're buying coffee. They're a bastard when they put on the uniform. Because to perform the role that the uniform demands is A, one of violence, B, one of protecting capital, and C, enforcing white supremacy. And to do that, you are a bastard. I don't care if you're just, if you're doing community policing, if you're kissing babies, you're, you know, doing whatever PR shit you're doing. I don't care. Because at the end of the day, to perform the role that the uniform demands, you have to do one of those three things. And that's what it comes down to. I don't care how polite they are when they order coffee or what role they have in church on Sunday.
This is an important distinction that I swear to God I've been talking about for decades, and I don't know how many people have grasped this yet, but for the love of God, our society's not going to go anywhere until we do, is that a uniform is a choice, an identity is not. And there is a distinction here that we keep missing. And it's really, really important that we get that, is choosing to wear the accoutrement of power and choosing to exercise that power is a personal choice. You can take off a uniform. You can set down the baton or use it for other purposes, however you like. You don't have to be that thing. You don't have to do that. You choose to do that. And it may be a choice you feel you don't have a better way out of, but as Jesus Christ himself said, sell everything you have and follow me. Like, self-sacrifice on that level is part of the Christian journey. And so, well, you know, I know we hate making blanket statements. It's kind of hard to call someone a Christian if they stick on that particular choice. Like, if you are going to wear the accoutrement of power, if you're going to exercise the means of power through violence against other people simply so that you continue to draw a paycheck, that's an issue. Like, that is a faith issue, fundamentally.
You can't wear a cross and support the people that put Jesus on it at the same time.
Yeah. Fundamentally, you know, the cross demands that you take off your centurion helmet. Like, you pick one or the other. Longinus had to set down his goddamn spear.
My favorite line to just repeat to people so often is that I serve a God that was killed by the Roman state. Like, I serve a God who was killed by the cops. Why would I not be out in the streets protesting against the use of state power? Why would I ever be in favor of the idea of the state having the option to execute its own citizens, right? Why would I ever think that the state has the moral justification to do that, right? Not just the Roman Empire, but any empire. When humanity has proven itself so incapable of wielding power that we saw the embodiment of love and said, let's kill that. How can I ever look at that and say, yes, the state deserves to have power? I just don't understand how you can be anything but an anarchist when you see that.
That's why Jesus is an anarchist, because when the adversary came to him and was like, I will give you all of the states, all of the kingdoms, all of everything. And Jesus said, no, mm-hmm. That's anarchism. It just, who he is.
He did not regard equality with God as something to be clung to, but gave it up and took on the form of a human slave, right? Became like us, embodied like us, because that is who God is. God is love. God is sacrifices of themselves. And we as Christians are called to be little Christ, to give up the things that keep us from loving each other, like our jobs, when our jobs are the things that are causing us to harm our neighbor.
Even the status of deity is meaningless, because there is no status in the kingdom of heaven.
Absolutely.
Back to him being surprised that Joseph is alive. There's this kind of doubt about Joseph's intentions. Like, when he first sees his brothers, is he like, oh, fuck these guys. I'm gonna get them back. They're going to regret the day. Or is it one of mistrust? Because the last thing they did to him was fuck him up. So he's like, I don't know if I can trust these guys. Shit, they might be spies. So having them get Benjamin has dual possible roles. Like, A, yeah, bring me my brother that I have this connection with in my head. Or it's, have you killed him too? Because mm-hmm. if you haven't, then we might be in business. But if you have, oh, you're going in that same pit, buddy.
Here, from altar, looking at verses 7-9 in particular, the first piece of this is that the interplay between the verbs for kind of recognize and play the stranger that are being used here, for Joseph recognizing and then deciding to kind of hide himself from his brothers, they're derived from the same shared root. One's a reflexive form, the other's not. So there's a type of wordplay that's happening here that doesn't carry over into English very well. And it's establishing kind of thematic connections that travel all the way back through the story, going back to the pit story itself, where Jacob was asked to recognize, same root, the blood-soaked tunic. Tamar, in the same way, invited Judah to recognize her tokens. So that act of recognition of wrongdoing is all tied into this. Like, there's so many different layers of linguistic connection that are happening here. And then we get down into verse 9, which is where I think that Joseph's intentionality is coming into play. And we see Joseph remembering the dream. And the way it's represented here is very, very particular, because there they are lying prostrate before him. And exactly as it was in the dream, with the key fact that because of Joseph's position and the assumptions of the brothers, Joseph is the only one who's capable of recognizing that the dream is thus fulfilled. So we have reasonable cause to believe in this moment that Joseph knows what's happening and understands the context of the situation in a way that the brothers don't. And with a little grin, starts lubing himself up for what's to come next. And if you have any further questions about that, I'll be in my bunk.
Got it! So, and I just want to grab onto that term recognize, right? Where it is a recognize that they are recognizing the sinfulness, but that Joseph is recognizing the sinfulness, but his brothers are not recognizing that they have sinned against him in this way, right? They have both not recognized him physically and not recognized the evil that they have done. And like in so much so because they just think he's dead, right? They just assume that he could be nowhere. And so they aren't even capable of recognizing what they've done. The sin of omission has become so great. I really love that. This ties back to the conversation about power, right? That here we have Joseph recognizing the power that he has now. He alone is the one who recognizes, oh, all these shafts of wheat are bowing before me, and I am actually on top now, right? I am actually the leader of all of these ones. And I am over and above them in this way. And that's when he starts to use his power in this corrupting way, right? He says, instead of talking to them normally, he says, you're spies, right? You are coming here to undermine the power of this region, and I represent that power, and so you're not going to get out of here. I'm going to take one of your brothers, right? And here in this way, when Joseph is taking one of his brothers away, he is symbolizing the later division of the kingdom, right? This is being redacted in the Babylonian exile when there have already been a division of 10 tribes against 2, the northern kingdom of Israel versus the southern kingdom of Judah. And Benjamin, whose name is literally son of the south, right, representing that sort of division, right, that the 10 are there, they're separated away from the 2 that are left. And so this is pre-telling, right, of what's going to happen and say, oh, you betrayed us, right? The 10 betrayed the 2. And telling the story from the perspective of Judah, of course, with Joseph here instead of Judah, but the 10 versus the 2 being present here as a power dynamic, and the 2 being as powerful or more powerful than the 10. But Joseph then goes on to use his power and throw one of his brothers in jail to manipulate them, right? And even goes so far as to throw this silver in their face and say, look, this is what you got for me, so I'm going to give it back to you, causing you to be afraid of the consequences of coming back.
I've got a couple thoughts about famines being entirely political and not generally when there's a famine, it's because the area is being exploited by somebody else, and that somebody else could be not exploiting the people of the area and leaving them enough food to eat. You know, like the famously the Irish potato famine, like Ireland was growing enough food for themselves, but thing was, England was like, no, that's my food. My potatoes, please. And that left the peasants in Ireland to starve. Just like, I don't know the specifics about this point in time in ancient Egypt, but ancient Egypt was constantly trying to expand, and with like higher demands on their populations being devoted towards like building projects and trying to like prove power that way, that takes away like their actual farmers. and encourages like this military state to get more people in the military, which creates more demand for grain from other areas too. And it encourages enslaving other people to support like the food production process, and that leads to overexploitation of certain parts of the land. And of course, like, you know, like maybe the Nile was just like not working out at this point in time, but
crucially to the story, it wasn't Egypt that was experiencing the famine because they stored up. It was Canaan. They're coming to Egypt for the food, which, to your point, like, is Canaan, an exercise of power that Joseph is then able to take advantage of over his brothers in that same political way. So, like, you can take the, I think you, to your point, I think you can take the family dynamic of Joseph now being in power, in which case his brothers were right to be unnerved by that dream, because and especially in the way that he abuses power, you can kind of expand the family dynamic as Joseph being occupying the place of empire and his brothers occupying the places that empire ravages for its own profit. I don't know how harebrained.
But also, like, Canaan, like, ancient Canaan was constantly being fought over by more than just, like, the ancient Israelites, like, the Hittites, the Assyrians, like, the Sumerians, whatever. Like, all of them were constantly, like, expanding and shrinking their empires, and, like, part of the war process is, like, ravaging the land so people can't, like, enjoy it, too. So, like, that's probably definitely another factor in this famine.
There's a piece in here, too, that you kind of danced over that I think is worth exploring as well, which is not to say Joseph's brothers were totally 100% right, but they did, I think, adequately identify, even in his youth, the fact that Joseph should in no way be trusted with the kind of power he was seeing to have over them. And this is a theme we get a lot in the Bible, is when people realize, wow, this needs to not be the case. And then they overreact wildly in the other direction and wind up either causing something worse or causing the thing that they were trying to avoid to happen in the first place. To a certain extent, like, there is a lesson to be taught here about the virtue of proportional response. Like, Joseph's brothers, I think, were right to realize that, wow, here's this full of himself little shit saying we're all going to bow down to him. And, like, we all know each other. We're all brothers. We hang out with each other. And I know that this is the sort of guy who, if given power, would fuck everything up for everyone. He would give all of the resources to the state and then lord it over people and have us all bow down. No, he should not ever have power. Let's kill him. Like, okay, wow, you had an idea, and then you took it too far. Who the hell do you think you are, Elon Musk? Come on.
Well, like, well, and like in any functional family, that problem would be taken care of with some light bullying. Maybe not so light, you know, maybe we stuff Joseph into a locker every once in a while, give him a good swirly or two, but like murder seems a bit far.
I think you're being kind to Elon Musk in asserting that he has an idea.
Yeah, he has ideas. But also, Micah, you just endorsed bullying.
I'm endorsing bullying over murder.
I will say, though, to soften the pro-bullying message in favor of the podcast here, there are certain things when we're young that we do, that we act, that we kind of, in ways that we behave, that are, if not via bullying, softened out through the regular erosion of social interaction with our friends, our family, and our peers. And the fact that the error on the part of Joseph's brothers, of course, was to not provide for that and to not have enough faith in God to sand off the rough edges over time. We're all works in progress. We are all, if you will, unfinished. Plug.
I'm obviously joking about bullying people. What I am saying is that, like, that exactly what Don was saying is that in normal social interactions, you say things and then people react to them. And based on the way that they react, you often realize, oh, that's not an appropriate thing to say out loud. Like, hey, I'm going to be the boss of all you losers one day. Or, bitches, bow down to me. Those things, if you started to say them out loud and realize, oh, these people are having a negative reaction to me, could often be things where we have this reaction and recognize that that's not the case. Now, what I really want to be very clear on is that we have previously discussed the fact that this maps on to Joseph's potential neurodivergency, right? The fact that he doesn't pick up on this going on is a good sign that we should read him as neurodivergent. He's not picking up on the social cues, that what he is doing is having a profoundly negative impact on the people around him. All of that to say that bullying is obviously not an appropriate response to people who are not correctly understanding social cues, right? Those are things that need to be explained and talked through so that we can come to a better understanding, right?
So in the way I'm pushing back on the neurodivergent view, at least in this one, is one, I'm neurodivergent, and I learned how to not be a prick, but you also unlocked some like terrible memories for me. So my dad was very into like making me and my siblings think we're superior to other people, just, you know, in the way that, like, in a very negative way, that, like, we're better than other people just by inherently being who we are, which is, like, a horrible thing to be. But that makes me kind of recognize Jacob's favoritism towards Joseph is gassing him up to be this little shit. Like, Joseph gets the special coat. Like, Joseph is the firstborn son of the favorite wife. He's going to be treated as such. If I know any, if my religion wise has taught me anything, like the favorite children get a lot of special attention that the other children do not get. So he's up to have this dream of like, well, I had a dream that you're all chaffs of wheat and you're going to be bowing down to me. That's Jacob's doing in his favoritism, and it plays out through how Joseph like bootlicks his way to middle management so he can have this power over his brothers. And no, murder is bad, attempted murder is bad, selling your slavery is bad. There had to have been some like extreme rifts in the family for that to lead all the way up there.
This is the overall arc of the entire story of the Bible, in case anybody isn't paying attention. Everybody's bad always. It's like we learn from this. There are no perfect people. Everybody sucks. By the way, in case any of you are theologians or theological types out there, what I've just given to you is what's called the doctrine of total depravity. Everybody sucks always, but we all try to be better because God.
We should all try to be better because it's what we owe to each other as imperfect beings trying to share this rock.
And I don't accept the doctrine of total depravity, but I'm often quite close to it.
At the risk of starting an entirely theological debate, I'll put that right up there with most of Calvinism on the altar of shit that nobody ever actually really understands. But I just like, hey, I heard somebody say yes. This meant that everybody's constantly irredeemably evil and I hate it. Like, well, no, that's not what it actually says. John Calvin didn't all that shit about predestination. This is actually a huge thread in fucking internet Christianity where we're like wildly misinterpreting what traditional theologians have said and then hating on them for it. Like, no, they have good causes to hate on them. Like, give them that. Stop making shit up.
It's because no one reads theory.
I really wanted to pick up on something that Elle was saying, because I just love that this interpretation. Elle was talking about the way that this dream comes up, and the way that she was talking about it was very much so like how we, in our modern concept, talk about dreams, right? In the ancient context, dreams were this sort of magical thing. They help you see the future. We see that throughout the Joseph story, right? That it is foretelling and all of these sort of things. But the way that Elle just interpreted this, it really brings to light the way that we in our modern context read it, right? You have a dream. Well, most of us don't go to our REM cycle and, you know, wake up from our dream cycle and go, oh, I want to be a lawyer, or I want to do this thing, or I want to have 6 kids. You know, those, we talk about dreams as things, the things we aspire to, not as something that is literally cognitively happening in our brains while we're in a state of rest, right? And that, to me, is how this story played out, right? Where it wasn't that Joseph went and had a dream and then came out of it. You know, maybe that was something that was in his subconscious because Jacob was constantly reinforcing to him, you're the special one. You're the only one who gets a princess dress. You know, you're the most special one. And then he absorbs that, and in his subconscious he says, I'm the only special one. I'm going to be above everyone else, right? It might not be what Jacob said, but it's the implicit message there, right? And then we see that fulfilled, not because it was fate that this happened, right? But precisely as Al said, because Joseph aspired to be this person, right?
He manifested it.
He girl bossed his way all the way to the top of the literal pyramid scheme. So Joseph, like, the reason this episode is called Joseph the Cop is because Joseph has this power. He goes and abuses this power to his own ends, right? And Elle very correctly points out that it's not the same as the kind of things that happen in actual police forces, right? Because they are presumably supposed to be doing a job, whereas Joseph is powerful enough, he can just do whatever the hell he wants. But it's called Joseph the Cop because that is the easiest way to say that power corrupts, right? That Joseph, this person who had previously been using his gifts and abilities to help the people around him and to scale through these terrible situations, is now using his power corruptly. And we'll see later on that Joseph uses the power that he's accumulated. He makes it even more extreme. He basically undercuts all the power bases of the rest of Egypt. But that starts here. And just as El said, that the famine is often caused by political ends, right? That I think that Joseph caused the famine by the actions that he took, by accumulating all of this extra thing, all these extra plenty, and keeping it instead of sharing it with the people. But this is really where it starts. He gets this little bit of power, and he uses it over his family. And what does he do? He gets them there. He lies to them. You know, which constitutionally they're allowed to do. just a friendly reminder, my friends. And instead of shutting up like you should do, they spill all the beans, right? And they say, oh, well, we have this other brother. And he gets them to talk the way that he wants to, right? By playing bad cop. And when they finally do, he makes them a deal, a little bit of a good cop, right? No, go with you, right? And then he really plays good cop. He puts the silver back in their donkeys. Well, in Sunday school, right, that was taught to us as, look, he's giving the money back. He's sending it back to them. He's giving them back the riches. He's not charging them for it, right? No, look at how afraid it makes them. They're like, we're going to have been accused of stealing all this stuff, which he later does, right? He later uses this to jail Benjamin and keep Benjamin there so that he can get his father there, right? So he can manipulate them, almost giving his father a heart attack, right? He jails his brother Simeon so that he can get around this other means, right? So that he can get his brother Benjamin there. And then that even is not enough. And he has to go back and abuse his power again.
Planting evidence is a cop move.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, there's a chain of thought that is fairly unique to policing that we see at play here as well, which is you start from the position of your own justification, and then you repeatedly take actions to shore up that justification because you start from a position of believing you're right, and then you take continued steps to shore up that righteousness, to continue presenting the appearance of rightness on your part rather than letting your righteousness simply shine through. Because if you're right, you don't need to shore it up. You just need to get in there and do the right thing. This is what police officers do all the time when they're planting evidence. They're like, I'm the cop, therefore I'm right. You should respect my authority. And because you're not, I'm going to plant evidence. I'm going to beat the hell out of you. I'm going to throw you in jail. I'm going to do all these other things. Because at the core of it was the initial issue of I'm right and you're not. And Joseph is operating off of that exact same mentality here. And in that way, he's very, very much a cop because the truth is not relevant to what he's trying to do. This is the same mindset of someone who would look at the story of the boy who cried wolf and say with Garrick that the lesson is you shouldn't tell the same lie twice. Like that mindset is what's at play here. And yes, I did sneak in one more Star Trek reference because I had to. Anyway, continue.
But like, how often do I do that? Right? Like, I don't think Joseph or Copps are unique here in that situation, right? Where like, I start off by going, well, if I just compromise my morality on this thing, right? If I just compromise myself on this thing, and 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 suddenly I'm not living a life any better than the people that I'm condemning, right? And I think that goes back to the total depravity conversation as well, right? That I am not standing here as a righteous person who is able to condemn everyone else, right? I am also standing here as someone who is guilty of these things. But I don't want you to be stuck in a role where you can't ask for forgiveness and then escape from that, right? What I want for all of us is to not be stuck in that situation. As Christians, we are given the freedom to choose what is good, not just freedom to choose good or evil, but the freedom to choose the good. And that means giving up the things that keep us from being Christian, like having a job that depends on killing other people, like having a profession that relies on exploiting people, like supporting a state that forces us to be complicit in a genocide. We have to be free of all those things in order to choose the good for our neighbor.
I'm just going to go ahead and say that as a pastor, I really love the journey we've just gone on that began with Micah saying, I absolutely don't agree with the total doctrine of total depravity. And then coming around less than 5 minutes later to express it perfectly as exactly the way it's supposed to be, as the theological check that we have to keep us from constantly assuming our own self-righteousness and acting like fucking pop supporters. Like, congratulations, you came full circle on that. It's been a beautiful journey. Thank you for taking me along with you on this one. I've absolutely loved it.
I just want to end with, I know that if there's an episode that is going to get someone to contact my bishop and say, this person is not allowed to be a priest, it's going to be this one, right? And I'm sure that they won't actually listen to this podcast and get to this point. But I just want to offer that in 2020, during the protests, there was a gentleman in our area who's a disabled gentleman, African-American guy, beautiful soul. And we were marching pretty peacefully down the street. We were outside the police station, and then they brought out the pepper spray, and they brought out the rubber bullets, and they started the fire at us. And they directed a rubber bullet at this guy. You could see them aim at this guy because he was known to be in the community an activist for peace and an activist for Black lives. And that hit me instead. It hit me in the knee. It caused an MCL tear in my knee, and I hobbled around for weeks with that injury. Pretty minor injury compared to the things that faced a lot of the folks around us. But I carried a cane, and that cane gave me all sorts of privilege because suddenly I looked old, suddenly I looked frail, and suddenly my body was on the line. And so I was privileged enough to go up and demand cops to show me what their name is when they had them covered up, to ask for badge numbers when they had them covered up, because these were the police officers who were doing crimes against the people in my neighborhood, against the people who are most vulnerable, the people who had the least, the people who were living out on the streets that were being disrupted by protest, who were being disrupted by the response, by pepper spray being wafting through the streets and leaving no one untouched. Because some people thought that their position in society mattered more than the lives of other people. And to me, I think at this moment that the priesthood is my calling, but it does not matter to me more than the humanity of my sibling. And if it means giving up that calling, God will call me in another way. But I am called first to love my neighbor, and that's why I'm pursuing that calling in the first place. So friends, I hope, as you go, that you will likewise give up the roles that keep us from loving our neighbors, that we will give up the wealth, that we will give up the status, that we will give up our team instead to love our neighbors. and that we will love our enemies so much, we will call them to give them up as well. Take it away, Past Micah.
Thank you, Future Micah, and of course you, our wonderful listener. Together, we have made a wonderful and growing community on Discord that I look forward to being a part of every day. Your generous support on Patreon has already greatly increased the quality of our podcast, including this very outro. As an extra little thank you, you can get episodes early along with a bunch of other cool perks. Please follow the link in the show notes to join our Discord, Patreon, and all of the other things I mentioned throughout this episode. If you would like to reach me directly, you can reach me through the Discord or by email at thewordinblackandred@gmail.com. Now, Future Micah, say the profound shit.
And thank you, Past Micah. Now go and give up those powers that we cling to, that keep us from loving our neighbor. Shalom. He said to his brothers, "My silver's been returned. It's right here in my sack." "It's right here in my sack." Their hearts stopped, terrified. Do we all have silver in our sacks?
I don't know about you, Micah.